Next case is David Joseph Woods v. the U.S. Postal Service, 2012-3058. We'll hear from Mr. Bird when he's ready.
May it please the Court, my name is Charles Bird. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. David Joseph Woods. As we know, we're here regarding his appeal from the Merit System Protection Board arising out of his termination in connection with a few charges in connection with his government-issued credit card. It generally surrounds a handful of items, small amounts, an amount of like $104 or $280 or $149 and some others that he had requested reimbursement for because he may have canceled the return trip due to conditions and he had to catch another flight and he subsequently repaid it and things similar to that nature.
Well, but you use words of minimization. He may have a few small things, but we're not sitting here in judgment on whether he should have been removed. I mean, we're reviewing a judgment of the Merit Systems Protection Board, and we accord deference to fact findings.
Yes, Your Honor, but that is true. But if we look at the first issue, one of the first issues that we point out, and that's his inability to give an oral response.
He had an opportunity to and didn't, isn't that correct?
Well, Your Honor, what he did is he requested an extension of time to respond. That extension was granted to him. Within that extension of time, he requested essentially an oral, the opportunity to give
at the last minute on the last day.
And this court, in the Campbell versus Department of Transportation, this court upheld a denial, held that due process was not violated because the employee did not request an oral reply within the time frame that he could do a reply, which gives the clear impression that as long as you request it within the relevant time frame, you will be able to have an opportunity to have an oral reply. And we all know that oral replies are important.
Mr. Bird, let me get a factual question resolved, which I'm sure you can help me with, because this was a matter that wasn't we didn't have the underlying materials in the appendix, but you know them, and I'll ask. The administrative judge's opinion at pages 39 through 40 talks about the sequence of events here in a way that I think may give at least it. Misled me. It may give a misleading impression that the administrative judge says that there was an extension of time until October 26th, close of business, and that on October 26th, there was an electronic copy of his written response filed, and that, and we go on to say, they further stipulated that on the next business day, October 27th, Mr. Chiata received a hard copy version of the written response, including 14 exhibits. At the conclusion of his 13-page response, the appellant made the following statement: "At your convenience, I request to meet with you in person." Now, I take it, it sounded to me, and I initially thought that meant that he didn't make his request for an oral reply until the 27th. But I take it from other things in the record suggested that maybe that request was made on the 26th and that the sequence of sentences here is misleading. You follow me?
And that's exactly the situation.
So the request was actually made on the 26th.
Exactly, Your Honor. Okay.
It's in an email, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's in the record, I believe.
Yeah. Do we have that in the appendix? Because I didn't find it. Well, if it's there, that's fine.
It's in the appendix. Good. And I don't believe that the Postal Service is taking the position that he did not make that request in that 20.
I'm with you.
I think the position of the Postal Service is that that would take it beyond the 40 days, and I would suggest that based on the wording in this court in the Campbell versus Department of Transportation case, as long as the request is made within the relevant period,
that's the
most important thing. And in fact, we all know that a part of the due process case, that's why we're here today, because having the opportunity to be present and make an oral presentation is an important part of the due process.
Is that a due process matter?
Yes, Your Honor, because the Supreme Court had made it clear that you have a...
Under the Supreme Court case, it says you've got to either let somebody have a writing or an oral response. There has to be an opportunity to respond.
Yes, Your Honor.
The Supreme Court doesn't say you have to do both.
Well,
the regulations provide for both. A written reply and upon request an oral response.
And that's the position that we're taking
here. But my question is whether or not that's a statutory matter as opposed to a federal due process matter. I mean, you got to admit that your client was given an opportunity to respond in writing, and he did respond.
Yes, sure.
So we've got this additional requirement, and it seemed to me that the full board, when they took the case up, sort of dodged the question of whether or not the request was timely. The ALJ said the request was untimely, meaning that you must have, just the fact that you filed it on the close of business on the 40th day was out of time, according to the ALJ. The board didn't focus on that timeliness, but then said it was harmless error.
Yes, Your Honor, and we believe that it's long, and we've taken a position, and that's what this court's ruling in the Campbell versus Department of Transportation case suggests that as long as it's made within the relevant time.
I understand that, but the question is whether or not it would be a per se constitutional violation, assuming that you timely made the request.
Well,
that's subject to a harmless error analysis.
Well,
the Supreme Court has said, you know, that you look at due process in an overall setting.
Yes, Your Honor, but when we have to look at it, in connection with other matters as well, we believe that it's statutory and constitutional, but we also got to look at the fact that we had a situation where he wasn't provided all of the documentation, the transcripts that were available. Now, I know that the deciding official testified that he did not listen to them, but he did not say, and I think it's important, and I think the choice in language was very important in this case, he did not say he didn't know what the contents of them were. He did not say he wasn't advised of the contents of those transcripts and those recordings, and that would have been helpful to Mr. Woods. And we're not only talking about process and the perception of fairness in connection with that process. And here where you have a person being granted an extension, yes, it's beyond the 10 days he was tied to, but once you grant the extension, the same rules still apply.
Well, that's not, according to the testimony of the deciding officials at the hearing, they relied on the IG manual number 109. And they say, well, the rules around here are that pursuant to this manual, if you want an oral presentation, you have to request it within the initial 10-day period. That's a matter of our regulation. That's what the testimony was.
I understand it, Your Honor, but I would submit that when you grant an extension of time, that's
the IG manual, which I'm now looking at the transcript of the hearing. They say, well, the IG manual says that you have 10 days. The original 10 days is the time when you have to have an oral conference. If you grant an extension, it's only with regard to a written reply.
Well, I would suggest that wasn't clear to Mr. Woods, and the record doesn't suggest that was clear to Mr. Woods. And that's if that had been made clear, if they said, okay, we're giving you this extension, but you need to understand that it doesn't, it only applies to the written and not the oral, and then we may have been talking about something different, but that was not, he was, under the facts that we have, he was led to believe that he had additional, that he could do both. In addition to that,
so your bottom line view on the request, oral request, is that the extension from 10 days to 40 extended the time in which to make the request. He timely made the request at the last minute. He wasn't given the hearing, and that is both a violation of his constitutional rights and of his statutory rights, and is not subject or isn't excused for harmless error.
That is correct, Your Honor. In addition, we had the administrative law judge, as you know, one of these trips that kind of generated this whole investigation is when he went to Tennessee. And when he went to Tennessee, he and a co-worker that went with him did exactly the same thing. They booked the same flight. They had the same problems coming back. They had to cancel the return flight and get a ticket for another flight. Mr. Woods had contended that when he got back, he was told that even though he received the credit for the return flight that he didn't take, that he was to put in a request for everything. Ms. Hatton, the woman that went with him, did the exact same thing. And both of them didn't pay back the money. I think it was a couple of $100 to the government until they were approached by a supervisor. And his position in this matter was that this, I did what I was told to do. And so I want to call Ms. Hatton as a witness in my case in chief to say that this was, she did the same thing. And the court said, no, it would be cumulative. However, in this case, you got allegations, lack of candor, intentionally doing something, submitting false documents. And you would think that out of all of the witnesses that would have been proposed by the employee, Mr. Woods in this case, that the one employee who had under the same supervision, who did exactly the same thing that he did, he would be allowed to call that employee, because that would one, have a huge impact on his credibility, and you're having credibility determinations made all over the place.
I understood from the record that the administrative judge did not foreclose him from calling Ms. Hatton altogether, but just in his case in chief, and it allowed, specifically said he could call her on rebuttal, isn't that correct?
That is correct. And
so where's the prejudice?
Well, the prejudice is because the Postal Service did not elicit any testimony, knowing that, did not elicit any testimony for Ms. Hatton to rebut.
But if you're right that Ms. Hatton's testimony rebuts the core of their case, that this was intentional and knowing misconduct, then I'm not sure why she wouldn't have been admissible. In any event, she wasn't ordered excluded, I take it, on rebuttal, right?
Well, my understanding, I didn't represent Mr. Davis below, but from my reading of the record, the court deemed her testimony to be duplicative for his case in chief,
right,
and said and reserved on the ability to call her in rebuttal. She didn't guarantee rebuttal, but reserved the ability to call her in rebuttal. And from what I'm reading of the record is that at no time did they really suggest that his actions in this matter were intentional. They agreed that Ms. Hatton did exactly what he did. So it really, there wasn't too much to rebut. If anything, she couldn't rebut. But in connection with that she was not allowed to testify. And when you're dealing with credibility, it has a significant impact.
Mr. Byrd, you wanted to save 3 minutes. You're well into that time, but We'll give you a couple of minutes of rebuttal time.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Oliver.
May it please the Court. With respect to the alleged due process violation in connection with the oral reply, the Supreme Court in Cleveland Board of Education versus Lauderman made it very clear that an employee has a due process right to respond to a proposed action either in writing or orally. And that's exactly what happened here.
Well, I don't think there's this isn't really a due process issue. I mean, I think it's just Clevenger in this exchange with your opposing counsel has discussed it. I mean, among other things, you have process at the MSPB, which even if there were no process before the agency would satisfy due process concerns. But the question, that doesn't get you around the problem of the statute and the effect of the extension.
Sure.
So the question ultimately becomes, why wasn't the extension, in effect, one that at minimum led Mr. Woods to think that he had an additional opportunity to make an oral presentation?
Let's be clear on what the facts are.
Yeah.
Because the statute, of course, provides 7 days. The agency provided 10, and then in a letter to Mr. Woods with his counsel at the time said that you can make – I will give you a 30-day extension per your request and that you may make any reply that you wish to make during that 30-day period of time. That was both an email that Mr. Cihota, the deciding official, sent to Mr. Woods' counsel as well as a written letter.
Mm-hmm.
So it was clear from that communication to Mr. Woods' counsel that any reply – whether written or oral, should be made within the 30 days. But that's not what happened. What happened was at 5:28 p.m. on the last day of that extension, after having submitted a fulsome written reply, Mr. Woods' counsel asked for an oral request at that time. So in effect, what that is simply asking for another extension because there's no time.
Back up for a moment, and let's assume that this is a case in which we were dealing with your agency's 10-day rule. Okay, and that what Mr. Woods had done is came in at very close of business on the 10th day and said, here is my written reply and I request an oral hearing. Would that be a timely request for an oral hearing? The statute doesn't say that the hearing has to occur within 10 days. You say, in 10 days, you can do two things. You can request a hearing and you supply your written requirement.
Yes.
So what I need to know is whether or not on the 10th day, right at the close of business, he gives his written reply and he says, I'd like an oral hearing. Would you reject that? Would you say that that's untimely because the hearing can't be held within the 10 days?
Well, the agency gave him, pursuant to this internal regulation, 10 days. And so a request within those 10 days, we're not dealing with extensions at this point.
Request
within those 10 days is timely, but here...
That would be timely. The request within 10 days would be timely.
But now we're talking about
extensions. Now, what happens if they made it 11 days?
I think
gave you one more day. Would you get another day in which to request a oral hearing?
No, Your Honor. The Federal Circuit, Mr. Woods' counsel here, has pointed to this court's decision in Campbell versus the Department of Transportation. And there, the court is fairly clear on the topic of extensions. You have a baseline right a certain number of days.
Is that a precedential opinion? That's in Lexis.
Yes, it is. It's a 735 F. 2nd 497. It's a published opinion. And so in that case, the court is clear that it is incumbent on an employee to take the initiative in scheduling a time to exercise the right, but it also says that while the statute and regulation is clearly provided for a right to make an oral response to agency charges, they do not require the agency to schedule replies sua sponte. And it goes on to say that, well, in that case, no requests were made within the 7 days provided by statute. There was no obligation on the agency to extend the time for reply.
Well, I guess the question ultimately comes down to what was the communication to him in the extension? Was he told in... There was no reference to the oral reply opportunity in the extension. All that was said was any reply he wishes to make must be received by that date. And then the question is, what effect does that have on a request for and the timing of an oral presentation if he wanted to make one? Now, I guess your position is if he was going to make one, he'd better ask for it early enough in the 30-day period that he would be able to reasonably have it within that 30-day period.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. I think the statute itself, 5 U.S.C. 7513, says you have 7 days. Of course, the agency gives you 3 extra days. But he ultimately was given 40 days in which to make an oral reply, and he did not make a request for an oral reply until the close of business, or perhaps even after the close of business, on the last day of the what was a 40-day period.
But you wouldn't argue, I'm sure, that if he had come in, let's say, 3 weeks before the expiration of the 30 days and said, I'd like to make an oral reply, and the agency had said, well, we're really busy, we don't have time for you for the next 2 months. And then when the 2 months ran, they said, well, you know, this is outside of the 30-day period. That you wouldn't argue that that would be okay for the agency to do.
Well, that's a different scenario.
I'm actually fishing for what your answer would be to that.
Right. Well, I mean, that is a different scenario. I think
what's your answer, though, in that?
The answer is, if he made a request within 30 days for an oral reply, he would have, and the agency did not act upon it, and basically give him, you know, an opportunity to make that oral reply, then that would be an issue that this court can consider whether or not there was some sort of procedural effect.
What's the issue to consider?
Well,
are you dancing away from the testimony of your person on IG Manual 109, right?
No, Your Honor. The testimony
was that our internal rules, at least, are that if you want a hearing, you have to ask for it in the initial 10-day period. That any extension we give is only with regard to written replies.
Right. Well, let me be
clear. Now, that's not – I gather that regulation is not public, so it's right. Nobody knows about it.
Well, let me be clear, Your Honor, and I apologize if I haven't been clear. The oral reply, in terms of whether or not – the issue of whether or not there's a procedural effect, if there's not an oral reply within the time period that the agency has provided, they have 7 days. I think the seven days is public. It's part of the statute. It's a statutory –
You burden yourself with 10 days.
Right, exactly. So we offered him 10, so we gave him more than we were statutorily required.
We offer everybody. It's an agency-wide rule.
It's an agency, right. It's not
everybody gets 10 days.
Everybody gets 10 days, and everybody gets more than what's statutorily required.
So what?
Right, and so if he did not provide an oral reply within that time, so he has a right within that time period to provide an oral reply.
Now I'm getting a little confused again. I thought I understood your position, but is it your position, with respect to the agency's 10-day rule, that if he comes in at 5:28 on the 10th day and says, I want to make an oral reply, that he's too late because there's not time between 5:28 and the end of the day to have that reply? I thought your position was in the first 10 days he can make his request to make an oral reply and or submit a written response, and that if he makes a request for an oral reply in the 10 days, the proceeding in which he gives this oral reply will be held at some reasonable time thereafter.
Well, that's correct. I mean, the agency is not going to have any problem if he submits an oral request within the time period that was provided in the
regulation. Even if the actual proceeding of the reply doesn't occur until later.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But that doesn't apply, you say, to the extension in this case.
It doesn't. I mean, and that's true under this court's precedent, including the one that Mr. Woods' counsel pointed to, the Campbell versus the Department of Transportation. It's also true under other Federal Circuit precedent that I've cited in my brief, that in terms of extensions, there's no entitlement to an extension. We're only talking about the period of time, either by statute or by the Department of the Postal Service regulation. And so,
have a page in a record where the agency said to him any reply must come within the 40 days?
Yes. Give me 1 second, Ron. Appendix page 1278. At the very top of the page, it talks about the fact that the deciding official followed this email up with a letter to petitioner's counsel was again confirmed that John Tejeda shall anticipate receiving any response he wishes to make on or before the close of business.
So do we have the full letter in the text anywhere?
No, Your Honor. The full letter is not was not made part of the appendix. But that's an accurate quote, and I don't believe Mr. Wood's counsel would disagree with that. They accurately quote the email and the letter.
We shall anticipate receiving any response?
Yes, and that's referring to an actual oral reply, not just a request for an oral reply. So that's, he was on notice, and he didn't do so. Had an opportunity to do so, to provide an oral reply, and he didn't make a request on the very end of the business. That's not a procedural defect, and even if it were, it's not, for the reasons I've articulated, it's his burden to prove that's a harmful procedural error, and that's not by statute. It's his burden, and he hasn't proven, can't prove that his, the lack of an oral reply.
So you would, this is because there was an extension of time period. You wouldn't make that argument within the original 10
days. I'm sorry. Correct, Your Honor. This is, we're talking about extensions. There's no obligation to grant an extension under the Federal Circuit case law. And here, it's clear that he didn't even make the request until the end of close of business.
He testified at the MSPB, I take it.
Mr. Tejeda?
No.
The deciding official, Mr. Woods, Woods. Mr. Woods did testify.
Yeah. And one thing that confused me a little, normally the agency bears the burden of proof in the MSPB proceedings and goes first. But the reference to the witness being admissible in rebuttal confused me a bit. How did that come to pass?
Yeah, and you're referring to Ms. Haddon, the
yes,
alleged
Haddon
comparator. So what happened was initially the agency objected to the petitioners raising the issue of a disparate treatment because it was not pled in the affirmative defense. There's no question it wasn't pled in the affirmative defense.
Right.
So the administrative judge said, well, we're not going to allow, this testimony is going to be cumulative. We're not going to allow Ms. Haddon as a case in chief. We'll reserve the right to call her in rebuttal. And the reason that's important here, why it's not an abuse of discretion, because ultimately, as the full board found, the administrative judge should have considered disparate treatment in connection with the penalty, whether or not the penalty was reasonable. Well, as you know, the penalty, whether or not the penalty was reasonable, that's the burden's on the government to prove that the penalty was reasonable.
Right.
Therefore, it would have been logical for Mr. Wood's counsel to call Ms. Haddon in rebuttal to the evidence that the government presented that the penalty indeed was reasonable. They chose not to do so, even though it was their reserved right to do that. We made, the agency made Ms. Haddon available, but they never exercised their right to call her.
I guess I understand all that, but I guess what I'm still a little confused is a purely ministerial matter of who went first in this case. I mean, normally, if the government has the burden of showing that there was misconduct and it was the penalty serves the efficiency of the service, or whatever, 75-12 languages. If that all is the burden of the government, normally the government would go first, and rebuttal wouldn't occur. The rebuttal would be the government's rebuttal. Why did he go first for some reason in this case?
My understanding is that he did not go first. The government went first.
So what's rebuttal all about?
The rebuttal was what he would have had the opportunity after the government put on evidence of reasonableness to say, Your Honor, we have Ms. Haddon.
But that would have been done in the government's case in chief, which was first, right? And therefore, you would assume that everything he put on would come next. And therefore, what's the distinction between rebuttal and case in chief? I'm not sure this is terribly important, but since we seem to be attaching some significance to the fact that the administrative judge permitted Ms. Haddon to be used in rebuttal, but there's an objection from counsel that that wasn't good enough, and I'm confused about what the rebuttal is in this context.
Right. Well, that's an interesting question, Your Honor. I mean, because it is clear that the government called its deciding officials and made its case first, and Mr. Woods followed with his testimony.
And he did not call Ms. Haddon?
He did not call Ms. Haddon.
Either then or at some unspecified later time.
Exactly.
That would have fallen under the rubric of rebuttal?
At no point did he attempt to call Ms. Haddon.
Final thought, Mr. Oliver?
We did not get a chance to discuss the issue of the transcripts, which Mr. Woods' counsel brought up as an additional due process violation. So I have just 30 seconds to bring some clarity with regard to that. All right. At issue, Mr. Woods was interviewed 3 times by the agency, and it was recorded. He knew about it. He consented to it. And one of the transcripts of those interviews was not actually transcribed until 6 months after the removal decision. So the idea, so there's certainly no due process violation with respect to that transcript. The other two transcripts were provided pre-decisional before there was a removal, before removal, so there's no due process violation there. And as for the actual audio recordings, again, no due process violation because Mr. Cejudo's testimony is that he did not listen to the audio recordings. He relied upon the transcripts. And finally, in terms of whether or not there was any procedural defect with respect to not the agency not providing the audio recordings, well, there's none because he knew about the audio recordings for the reasons I just mentioned. It was consented to, and he was aware of it, but he didn't ask for it. He asked for other things, but he never asked for the audio recordings. And so even though he knew about it, even though he was represented by counsel, so there's certainly no procedural defect in the agency not providing the audio recordings for the ones that with respect to the recordings that were available pre-decision.
Thank you, Mr. Oliver. Mr. Byrd has given you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, I just want to deal with the rebuttal aspect, and that was one of the problems I have. If the government goes first, and then Mr. Woods will go next, that's what he was asking to do, is to have Ms. Haddon, in this case, in chief. The rebuttal would be the government. There would be no rebuttal for Mr. Woods. And that's the problem, because when he's going for second in his case in chief, he wants to call her. The administrative judge said, I'm not going to let you do it.
Well, but the administrative judge went on to say, but I will consider allowing her to be called in rebuttal, whatever.
Yes, and my point is, if the government goes first, then he goes second. That's his case in chief. That's not rebuttal. Then the rebuttal is the government coming back to rebut what Mr. Woods
said. She was talking about Mr. Woods being allowed to call her, not the government being allowed to call her.
I understand that. But if in the government's rebuttal there was no testimony about this issue, then what we're talking about is Mr. Woods having an opportunity really for server rebuttal. And so if it wasn't raised in the government's rebuttal, there is no server rebuttal. Also, with respect to the documents and the recordings, again, he said he didn't listen to them, but he didn't say, I wasn't aware of the contents. No one didn't advise me. I didn't have a summary of it. And I think it's a very careful choice in language in that regard. So I see that my time is up, and I would request that the court vacate these decisions and remand this case back to the agency for the, at a minimum, a holding of an oral reply and vacate decision of the Merit System Protection Board. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Byrd. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you.